Today, I'm pleased to announce Alicia Guerra, whom all of you, I'm sure, know. But we, and this is a topic that was requested, actually, by you guys. So, and that is very exciting. Love that when that happens. Really appreciate you guys sending ideas for topics, because we, you know, obviously want these to be on topics that you are interested in and trainings that you will find worthwhile. So please send us your ideas. So, and Alicia, when we got feedback that this was a topic that interested many of you, Alicia was willing to step up and do that. And, of course, we really appreciate that. Alicia, as I'm sure most of you know, has been with the program for a while now. She was a supervising attorney in the 7th Circuit and then the 20th, and she's now a regional attorney. And for those of you who know her, you know that Alicia is a great source of information and knowledge. And Liz and I joke that she's a walking version of Chapter 39, because she can pull up those numbers like no one I've ever met. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Alicia.
All right. Mary Kay, can you hear me? Is the mic picking me up?
Yep. You're good.
All right. Our continuing legal education topic is best interest. We selected this topic based on questions of how to quantify best interest and when to apply it as a standard. First, the Guardian Ad Litem program is appointed to represent the best interest of children in dependency proceedings, as explained in our standards of operations, specifically standards 1.0 and 1.1, and hopefully in every one of our appointment orders. Our Guardian Ad Litem best interest advocacy can generally be described as ensuring safety, advancing timely permanency, while enhancing and promoting the child's overall well-being. The mission and role of the program in the dependency proceeding is a distinct concept from best interest as a legal standard. There's often a misconception that in advocating best interest of a child, the program simply needs to offer the judge a recommendation on how she should rule on the legal question before the court. That's definitely not what best interest practice means. If the program is offering only the opinion of its volunteers and staff on how it thinks the court should rule, then it's not fulfilling its role and mission. There is no decision the court is required to make in a dependency or termination parole rights proceeding that's merely an adoption of the opinion of a guardian ad litem. In fact, the court has the right to reject the recommendation of the guardian ad litem after it has given the recommendation the consideration it's required by law. In fulfilling the program's mission, one role of the program attorney is to know the proper standard to apply for the type of proceeding before the court, and to know what evidence is required to meet the burden of proof. This is necessary to ensure the client is properly advised about the legal impact of the facts they bring to the attorney, and to ensure the client's legally obtainable objections can be put before the court and supported in the record when the matter is ruled on by the court. In a Chapter 39 proceeding, the court typically must decide legal questions based on two standards, those standards being, one, harm, and two, best interest of a child. Best interest of the child isn't just our role and mission, it's actually a quantifiable legal standard. In some instances, the court will have to make findings as to both standards, such as at a shelter hearing or a termination of parole rights adjudicatory hearing. In those situations, harm is a threshold issue. If the court determines the child has not been harmed, the matter is over before the court gets to the best interest analysis. For many hearings, which will be described in a moment, evidence of harm or endangerment must be offered to the court, and a legally sufficient order must be rendered, which includes findings that the child has been harmed or is in imminent danger of being harmed. Harm is not a generic term. It is defined in the statute. Now, I've broken the material down into two parts. The first part is we're going to talk about harm as a standard. And in the second part, we're going to talk about best interest as a standard and where it's applied. in the situations where best interest is a standard, the legislature has written instructions in the statute as to what factors the court has to consider for best interest. So we'll take those and be able to quantify best interest for each type of hearing where best interest is a standard. But first, we're going to talk about harm so that you're able to differentiate between harm and best interest. Now, as I said, harm is defined in the statute. It's 39.01-32, and Liz provided you with that definition. In looking at harm, you also have to look at the definitions of abandonment, which is 39.01-1, neglect, which is 39.01-44, and abuse, which is 39.01-2. So we're going to talk about harm as a legal definition. Harm is inflicting or allowing to be inflicted physical, mental, or emotional injury. Such acts may include excessively harsh discipline or cruelty, or where the parent has provided inadequate supervision for the child's age or mental or emotional or physical condition. Now, in the statute, you have to pay attention to the conjunction, you know, and, but, or, and the dependent clauses. It's never just the first part of the sentence where there's a dependent clause. Here, there's a dependent clause. So let me say it again. Such acts may include excessively harsh discipline or providing inadequate supervision for the child's age or mental, emotional, or physical conditions. For the inadequate supervision, it's where the child is unable to care for his needs or to exercise good judgment in a crisis. So it's not just leaving the child home alone. You have to have the second part. Harm includes willful acts that produce anything from cuts, bites, temporary disfigurement or temporary impairment, to suffocation, punctures, burns, and permanent disfiguration or permanent impairment. Willful acts are those situations where the action is intended. It does not require that the consequences of the action to have been intended. Willful acts can include purposely giving a child chemical substances which affect the child's behavior, motor coordination, or judgment, or causes the child to be sick or have internal injury. So, for example, if a parent gave a child sleeping pills and the child died, and the parent says, "I only wanted him to go to sleep. I didn't mean for this to happen." The act of giving the child the sleeping pill was willful, so it's not relevant to the harm that the parent didn't intend to cause the child to die. So the child has been harmed under our definition. It's not a defense that the parent didn't intend the consequences of their action. Harm includes abandonment. We know that abandonment is where a parent has made no provision for the child's support and, one of those conjunctions, has no positive and substantial relationship. We also know a substantial and positive relationship includes frequent and regular contact, through frequent and regular visitation or communication, and the exercise of parental rights. Marginal and token efforts are excluded. Neglect is a form of harm. Neglect is not poverty. It is deprivation of life necessities. And it can be the environment the child is permitted to live in. I know there's dependent clauses here, though. It's a deprivation when the environment causes significant impairment or imminent risk of significant impairment to the child's physical, mental, or emotional health. Now, that term in there, imminent risk, is a buzzword that means we got to prove a nexus, and I would refer you to the 2007 training that Tom Young did that's on the website to freshen up on what nexus is exactly. Just briefly, though, the terms prospective and imminent are not defined in the statute. You're going to see them used interchangeably, though, but you need imminent, not necessarily just prospective, because prospective means likely to happen or expected. Imminent is narrower in time and means intending or about to incur. So imminent danger requires proof of a nexus between the parent's acts or omissions and harm to the child. Nexus is not a generalized concern. It is a link, It is a connection. It's a chain of causation. It requires evidence of how the parents' acts, which were not directed at the child, have harmed the child or create substantial risk of impending harm. So when you have direct evidence that one child is physically abused, then there's no nexus requirement. Where you have one child who is physically abused and another child in the same household, you can either prove, you can prove direct harm to the first child, but with the second child, you're going to have to prove imminent risk based on the parent's access to the first child, posing an immediate and substantial danger to the second child, or you're going to have to prove neglect by showing that the environment that the child is living in, where the other child is being abused, has emotionally, physically, or mentally impaired child. And you're going to have evidence of that. The risk of harm cannot be conjecture. So harm can be substance exposure. It can be unreasonable restraint or isolation. It can be violent behavior that demonstrates a wanton disregard for the child's presence. However, it also has to be likely to result in serious injury. Again, you have to have a nexus for that definition of harm. It can be negligent failure to protect. Again, not just failure to protect, but negligent failure to protect. It can be impeding an investigation. And then just generally going back to the definition of abuse, harm or abuse is any willful or threatened acts or omissions that result in physical, mental, or sexual injury or harm which causes or is likely to cause physical, mental, or emotional health to be significantly impaired. So first we're going to look at shelter. You're going to refer to 39.402, subsections 1, 2, and 8H. Shelter is a situation where the petitioner has to prove the child has been harmed. There's initially three prongs. You have to prove that removal is necessary because of one of the following: the child has been abused, abandoned, neglected, or is at imminent risk of illness or injury from abuse, abandonment, or neglect. Two, that the parent or legal custodian has materially violated a court-imposed condition of placement. Or three, that there is no parent, legal custodian, or adult relative known and available to provide care. There also has to be a finding that shelter is in the child's best interest. The court doesn't give us specific factors to consider here, the statute doesn't require or provide specific factors, but there is an additional finding that the child is at substantial and immediate danger in the home, and that the provision of appropriate available services will not eliminate the need for placement. So in other words, that harm cannot be mitigated by preventive services. So just having a violation of a court-ordered condition of placement is not going to get the child back into foster care. You're going to have to show that the child is at substantial danger in the home and that it's in the child's best interest. Moving on from there, dependency adjudication. It's section 39.507 and 39.521, which is the disposition section of the statute. I'm going to ask you to think back to your first year of law school and constitutional law. Because any interference in the constitutional right to the integrity of the family, which is enjoyed by parents and children, must promote a compelling need to protect the child. Both parents and children have a fundamental liberty interest in the parent-child relationship and in the integrity of the family unit. Parents are presumed to be fit until the state proves otherwise, and Florida law requires the state establish a compelling interest in protecting the child from harm through the least intrusive means. So during a Chapter 39 dependency proceeding, the least intrusive means test requires the petitioner to prove that the child will be demonstrably harmed without state interference with parental decision-making. I know you're all familiar with Fantoski v. Kramer and Padgett, and you should also be familiar with Beagle v. Beagle. And if you need those citations, we can go over those at the end. But that's where all those standards come from. An adjudication of dependency is an interference with the fundamental right of a parent to raise their child. Therefore, the court has to have evidence of abuse, abandonment, or neglect as those terms are defined in the statute in order to adjudicate the child dependent. Case law, you can refer to AMT v. State, which is the first DCA case in 2004, and there are a number of others which all say that the court's inquiry is not what does a child's best interest require. Rather, the court must review the evidence by a preponderance standard when deciding the question of has the child been abused, abandoned, or neglected, or is the child at imminent risk of the same. These terms have specific definitions in the Florida statutes, and the evidence must support the statutory criteria as the terms are defined. Next, we're going to look at 39.521. I believe certain sections of that have been provided to you. But specifically, we're going to look at when placement is with a non-custodial parent who is not the cause of dependency at disposition. When a child is adjudicated dependent with findings that only one parent was the cause of dependency, the court is required to place with a parent who is not the cause of the dependency unless there is evidence that placement would endanger the safety, well-being, or physical, mental, or emotional health of the child. In MMV, Department of Children and Families, which was a 5th DCA case from 2001, the court held the statute specifically preclude the court from making an independent consideration of the child's best interest in this circumstance. Just about all the circuits have weighed in on it, and they have all found that the non-offending parent has a presumptive right to custody, and this is mandatory and not subject to a separate determination of the child's best interest. The second DCA specifically took it up in NRA KH in 2009. They found the trial court had erred by applying the best interest standard instead of the 39.521.3b standard, which requires the child be placed with a non-offending parent without the finding of endangerment. When the court ordered a permanent placement with grandparents and the termination of protective services, and the court had never made any findings that the mother was the cause of the child's dependency. Now, a non-offending parent is not automatically entitled to the custody of a child. There has to be a home study, and the court has to find that placement will not endanger the child. In the case of PM, a 5th DCA case from 2003, the child was found dependent as to the mother, but not as to the father, even though there were serious concerns about possible sexual abuse by the father. The trial court placed the child in the custody of the department, and the father appealed. So the 5th DCA held the father had admitted to the facts which formed the basis for the allegations of sexual abuse. It also admitted to the allegations of domestic violence. In PM, it was unclear whether or not a home study had been completed. However, the trial court judge had made a specific finding that placement with the father would endanger the safety, well-being, or the physical, mental, emotional health of the child. In other words, he applied the 39.521.3b test and was upheld on appeal. The 5th DCA also held that the courts have the authority to impose requirements on non-offending parents. In the case of PM, this included tasks of psychosexual evaluation, domestic violence counseling, and parenting classes. The requirement of a home study has been found to be constitutional. It satisfies the least intrusive means test and is in furtherance of the state's compelling interest in the safety of the child. Now, when you have a situation where you're looking at reunification with a parent post-disposition, again, our standard is harm. We're not talking about post-permanency, we're talking about post-disposition. So it's where the child's been adjudicated and basically the parent is working on the case plan. It's before the court has entered a final order on permanency. So in these situations, the court is required to determine whether the parent has remedied the cause of child dependency to the extent that they can assume custody without endangering the child's safety, well-being, and physical, mental, and emotional health. This is 39.522 sub 2. Again, that's 39.522 sub 2. This substantial compliance with the case plan means that reunification is required to occur unless there is proof of endangerment. And a finding that the parent has not complied with the case plan isn't enough. There has to be proof and a finding of endangerment. So, the substantial compliance, we have to look back to the definition where, you know, we know substantial compliance means that the cause of dependency has been remedied to the extent the child will not be endangered. So those extra little case plan tasks about maybe a driver's license, that kind of thing, those things that don't really go to the child's safety, just the finding that the parent hasn't done that is not sufficient for the court's order. It has to be a finding of endangerment. And this will be your standard, whether it's a motion to reunify by the parent or whether it's, you know, our recommendation to the court or the department's recommendation to the court at a permanency hearing or on a motion for permanent guardianship. If the court is going to order a permanent guardianship, there has to be the finding of endangerment to the child, not simply that the parent didn't comply with the case plan task. So, moving on to the best interest standard. Now, what is best interest exactly? It's acts and omissions of the parent which bear on their capacity and willingness to parent. It does, in fact, include the parent exercising their fundamental constitutional rights to parent. And it's all those stability and well-being factors that we, as Gordian Lytle advocates, are quite familiar with. In fact, we have 16 factors detailed in the standards of operation. It's standard 1.2, and that also has been provided to you. And if you haven't read the standards recently, you really should read those again. Standard 1.2 specifically, and it does, in fact, include advocating compliance. Best interest is not superficial. It's not the child's preference to live in a substitute home over the parent's home. Now, in a lot of our tests for best interest, such as the manifest best interest prong of TPR, the post-permanency six-factor test, the child's preference is part of the test. But the child's preference alone does not make up best interest. Best interest is not conjecture. It is not a generalized fear. We typically see this generalized fear from our client about a child regressing upon reunification because they were doing terrible before they came into care. They've been in this wonderful placement for so long, and they're just doing wonderful. They act different. They have matured. They're just doing so extremely well. And while, you know, the drug problem may have been fixed, we think they're going to regress when they go back into the home. Well, that's not best interest. It's also not that feeling that, you know, there's something else about the parent that we just haven't figured out. There's something else going on. I don't know what it is, but there's a problem, and we shouldn't reunify. That's not best interest either. You can usually recognize when this is going on because you're going to hear the statement, I have a concern, I don't have any proof, but I just know, and you should trust me, the judge should trust me, everyone should trust me. If we ask the court to make a finding based on that, the court will be reversed. We have to have something more. Best interest is not the guardian ad litem's recommendation standing alone. As for the child's preference, guardian ad litem recommendation is often a part of a multi-pronged test for best interest. But as I said in the opening, it's never sufficient for the court to adopt the opinion of the guardian ad litem with nothing more and make its finding on a legal issue before the court. Best interest is also not least restrictive means, and there's a whole stock argument on that subject, so I'm not going to cover it here. So first we're going to talk about change of custody to non-parents or between non-parents. This is 39.5221, and the standard is best interest of the child. 39.5221 tells us that in applying the best interest standard, the court must include a consideration of the continuity of the child's placement in the same out-of-home residence as a factor. So the statute's telling us what the test is, or at least at a minimum what it includes. Furthermore, any non-licensed placement must meet homestead criteria and have court approval. So we also know this needs to be a situation where the court has, in fact, approved placement. We haven't just moved the child there. Now, we're all familiar with 39.521.1D8B. You may not have the citation memorized, but we've all heard it, and I'll say it again. It's 39.521.1D8B. That's the part of the statute that says both the department and the court consider transferring temporary legal custody to an adult relative approved by the court at a later date. Again, a really important dependent clause here, but neither the department nor the court is obligated to so place a child if it is in the child's best interest to remain in the current placement. So, again, in that dispositional section of the statute, it reaffirms the 39.522 best interest standard for change of custody to non-parents. Change of custody motions between non-parents are also subject to a legal presumption. Specifically, it is presumptively in the best interest of the child to remain in the home where he or she has spent the majority of his or her life. So that requires a little bit of math, but if you can figure out if the child's been in the home for more than 50% of their life, then there is a legal presumption that the child should not be moved. That's from N. Ray J.C., which is a third DCA case, which also said that, furthermore, trial courts have a duty to make placement decisions in the best interest of a child and to recognize the importance of bonding and attachments in early childhood relationships. In Rumpf v. Meade, which is another third DCA case from 1996, you had a situation where a child had been in a foster home for 3 years, and relatives moved the court to have placement of the child. There was also an added twist of racial diversity between the relatives and the foster parents. There was evidence of harm that the child would experience as a result of the disruption of the foster placement, and so the Rump Court decided that a change of placement to the relative's home would be inappropriate. One of my favorite quotes comes from this case. Then Chief Judge Swartz wrote a concurring opinion. The Chief Judge wrote that experience, common sense, and therefore the law teach, without the need for expert testimony, both that stability is better than disruption for the psychic health of everyone, and particularly small children, and that it is unwise to risk a known good in a certain present for the necessarily unknown possibilities of an uncertain future. I think that really explains the situation very well when we're looking at changing from one non-parent to another. Then we move on to visitation. Visitation is brought up in 39.402 sub 9. That's the shelter part of the statute. And it's also brought up later in 39.621, which is the permanency part of the statute. For the purposes of shelter, in order not to give a parent visitation, there's a burden that visitation is not in the child's best interest. So first, you have the standard that visitation is, that for visitation, best interest is the standard. For shelter purposes, you also have to prove it by clear and convincing evidence. And that's going to follow us through the dependency process. We do have a case interpreting BM v. DCF, which is from the 4th DCA. It was a situation where the trial court had entered an order terminating visits with a parent. And it was reversed on appeal because the order was a sanction against the parent for using drugs. Specifically, the court held that it was legally insufficient because there was no finding that the termination of the visitation was in the child's best interest. So again, reaffirming that best interest is our standard for visitation. It's really noteworthy, though, that the court, the appellate court, made a finding that in no situations any threat to the child can be reduced just by making the visit supervised. And that district court of appeal held that even sporadic visits are better than no visits at all. So that's something to keep in mind when looking at terminating visitation. Now, a post-permanency motion for reunification, which is 39.61 sub 10, is also subject to the best interest standard. When a parent seeks to move the court to reopen protective services, increase visitation, or reunify with the parent, the court has to hold a hearing. That's according to 39.61 sub 9. After an order on permanent placement has been entered, that's going to have happened prior to the parent making this motion. So you're going to have an order with a permanent placement in effect. That permanent placement is intended to continue until the child reaches adulthood. And the court is actually prohibited from disturbing that permanency order unless the court can make a finding that the circumstances of the permanency placement aren't in the child's best interest any longer. Now, specifically for the motion for reunification, and also the motion for increased visitation, that's sub 10. It says the court shall base its decision on the effect of the decision on the safety, well-being, and physical and emotional health of the child. That's a best interest analysis. In this analysis, the following factors must be considered. That means the court has to consider all of them, and the court has to address all these factors in the findings of fact, in the order. So those factors are the compliance or noncompliance with parent placement. The court has to look back at the causes of dependency and whether or not those have been remedied to the extent that the child is no longer endangered by returning to the home of the parent. The court has to look at whether or not the parent has complied with TASP the case plan. The court has to look at the stability and longevity of the child's placement. So how long has the child been in this permanency placement? The court has to hear evidence and consider the preferences of the child so long as the child is of a sufficient age and understanding and able to express that preference. The court has to consider the recommendation of the custodian and also the guardian ad litem. So the court has to make findings on all six of those factors when entering an order, whether it's granting or denying a post-permanency motion for reunification with the parent. I refer you to LMB Department of Children and Family. It's a 4th CCA case from 2009, which made that specific finding that when ruling on the post-permanency motion for reunification, the court has to consider all six factors. And the court has to address them in its order. Now, in the first part of the materials, I didn't address the 39806 grounds for TPR. Those do have a harm standard to them, but we are going to talk about the best interest prong of the TPR test here in the best interest part of the training materials. Obviously, if in the first part of the TPR trial, if the court didn't make a finding that a ground was met, the court doesn't get to the best interest analysis. But we're going to assume that that has been met and the court is making that analysis. So we know very specifically that for manifest best interest for the purposes of TPR, that the legislature has given some very specific factors that make up the test. Any order terminating parental rights must have findings for not only all three prongs of TPR, which is one ground, manifest best interest, all 11 factors, and least restrictive means. The court is required to consider all 11 factors and anything else the court thinks is relevant to the best interest of the child for the TPR. During the trial, the attorney should never, never read the statutory factors and elicit a yes or no answer. Yes and no is not evidence. The case manager, the caregiver, relative, and the guardian litem are all witnesses, fact witnesses, who may all have relevant knowledge as to those factors, and which a well-prepared attorney can elicit in direct or cross-examination. Those persons are fact witnesses. Their opinion as to the existence or non-existence of the factors is not relevant to the court's consideration of the best interest. What you're trying to get is their specific knowledge about the permanent custody arrangement, their specific knowledge about the parent's capacity and disposition, and so on. So it's not a yes or a no. It's if the parent still hasn't finished drug treatment, that's what you want to find out. You want to find out the details. You don't want to ask them if the parent has the capacity and have them say, no, that isn't evidence. It's up to the court to decide the parent doesn't have the capacity, not the witness. The witness gives the judge the information on which to make the decision. Furthermore, the trial attorney has to make a careful review of the final order to make certain it contains all the necessary findings. Any order that misses any of the three prongs of TPR or that fails to consider all the factors of manifest best interest is reversible. The trial attorney has to take action to correct the error before it's allowed to delay permanency. If you get an order in and the court makes findings on manifest best interest and least restrictive means, but doesn't make a finding on grounds, you have to tell the court it made a mistake because it won't sustain appeal. Conversely, if the court orders parental rights terminated based on the grounds and makes no findings about manifest best interest, it is reversible. So make certain that you have not just yes and no as to those factors, but concrete evidence in the record and then findings in the order. Make certain that your TPR order is sufficient. Next, we're going to talk about change of custody from one parent to another under 39.521.3b. The standard there is, again, best interest of the child. At disposition, the court has the following options when making a placement with a non-custodial, non-offending parent. First, the court can order that reintegration services be provided to the parent from whom the child was removed. Second, the court can order services be provided solely to the parent who is assuming physical custody in order to allow that parent to later retain custody without court jurisdiction. Or three, the court can provide services to both parents, in which case the court has to review at every review hearing whether the parent, which parent, if either one of them, should have custody of the child. And in that situation, the standard is best interest. It is completely permissible to have a case plan that addresses the cause of dependency for the offending parent without giving the offending parent, or I'm sorry, without the case plan having a goal of reunification with the offending parent. I give you the case of FMV, Department of Children and Families, as a 4th DCA case from 2002. The 4th District Court of Appeal had ruled that a case plan goal, which is intended to permanently place a child in the home, supports stable care, fulfills the statutory directive, and that is specifically authorized by 39.521.3b2. So in other words, when you prepare the guardian ad litem disposition report for the dispositional hearing, you want to make a recommendation that the goal is reunification with the non-offending parent, basically, even if that child is already in the home, because our statutorily authorized goals are reunification, adoption. While you will typically see maintain strength and listed as a case plan goal, it's not statutorily authorized. Now, if the court approves that as a goal, it's not necessarily something that we want to raise error on. That was a situation in the FM case, which was found to be okay. But it's not something we want to recommend since it's not statutorily authorized. Our intention is that we want the child to remain with a more stable parent in the facts I'm discussing. So if you're not intending to reunify with the offending parent, then you don't want the court to approve that goal. Because if the case plan goal is reunification with the parents from whom the child was approved, then the 39.5222 standard mandates reunification occur absent evidence of endangerment of the child's physical, mental, or emotional well-being. That's the case even if the child was placed with the other parent. So, and that's the case even where there's concurrent goals of reunification with the offending parent and maintain strength with non-offending parent, which, as I pointed out, isn't statutorily authorized because, first, it goes against the definition of concurrent planning, but, second, because there is no statutorily authorized goal of maintain strength. However, that was allowed in the FMK. Also in DSV, Department of Children and Family Services. That's all the materials I prepared. I think Mary Kay may have left, but we can open it up to questions.
This is Eileen.
Hi, Eileen.
Hello.
Hello?
Hello, this is Eileen. Can I help you?
Did you have a question?
No, ma'am.
Okay, does anyone else have a question?
Can you hear me?
Hello?
I have a
Hi.
Question. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
I wondered if you had some notes that you were using that contained some of the information and citations that could be forwarded to us by email. It's been difficult to hear some of the sound transmission and to catch all of the sites.
I can do that also. I'm glad you brought that up. Liz is also going to put together either a practice bulletin or a checklist based on these materials so that you can have kind of a handy-dandy little chart like you do for your hearings, which will help you out. So either I'll have Liz send out my notes to you, or that chart will be coming your way.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
I had a question, Alicia. Can you hear me? It's Kamisi.
Hi, Kamisi.
Hi.
On cases where... And maybe I just missed part of what you said,
where a child is placed in the home with parents under court supervision, and they have a case plan but are not complying. If the children, can the children be removed under a post-disposition modification of placement with a standard of best interest without a show of harm, or are you saying that we would also have to, we would have to show best interest and harm, even though the child has already been adjudicated dependent?
Adjudicated and placed back in the home of the offending parent.
Yes.
When you're interfering with the parent's custody, my feeling is that you need to show harm. The best interest alone isn't quite sufficient. I don't know if Hillary or Wendy or anyone's on the line who has a different opinion on that, but my feeling is that you do need the harm.
I think you need the harm, Alicia. I agree with you.
Okay. Again, we're talking about that fundamental constitutional right, and I think we have to go back to Padgett and Tosti v. Kramer, which says that when we interfere with that, we have to show the compelling interest and the endangerment.
Okay, but that's not cured by the fact that the child has already been adjudicated dependent?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I think if the court had decided that it was safe enough to leave the child in the home, then there wasn't a finding of danger, and you're going to have to get that endangerment finding.
Okay.
Anybody else? Or Wendy, is there something that I was talking too fast about that I need to go over again?
No, I was fine with it.
Alicia, this is Tyler Dzinski from the 14th Circuit.
Hi.
Hi. I had a quick question about modification of visitation for parents. In a case where a therapist has recommended suspension of visitation due to coping skills not being adequate in a minor child post-disposition, is it best to go through the 39402, or should we go through the Keeping Child Safe Act, even though it doesn't have to do with sexual abuse?
Don't use the Keeping Child Safe Act.
Keeping Child Safe Act is a little constitutionally iffy.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're going to get a specific training on keeping children safe next month because it is a requirement. But when legitimately using the Keeping Safe Act, we do believe that there are some unconstitutional presumptions in there. We've got quite a few judges finding the act unconstitutional. Wendy, don't we have one that's going up?
Actually, no, none of them are going up because everyone agrees with the judges.
Yeah, we think at some point it might get struck. We're not able to defend it.
Okay.
So when you have a situation where you want to suspend those visits, even if the court's going to be fined about keeping children safe under the act, make sure you also have the evidence. So
right.
It's not just a presumption from the Keeping Children Safe Act, that you also have evidence for the court to base its ruling on and can actually make the best interest finding.
So go best interest through 4029 in the shelter order. And if the court wants to go the Keeping Children Safe Act, then let them do that.
Advocate very strongly that the court make the best interest finding.
Okay.
And that the court base it on actual record evidence.
Yeah, not just the presumptions that keeping children safe.
Okay.
Out.
We believe that if the parent takes it up, that the act could get struck, and then you lose your protection for the child.
Thank you very much.
Anybody else?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Alicia? You said impeding an investigation falls under negligently failing to protect. Do you have case law on that?
No. Impeding investigation is part of the statutory definition of harm.
Okay.
There isn't any case law I'm aware of interpreting it. You will often see DCF use that as their basis to get an order to go into a house and get a child. I don't think it quite gives them authority to get into someone's constitutionally protected space, but you often see that one used there for that purpose. I've never seen it used for any other purpose, in all honesty. It's just kind of there.
Okay, thank you.
May I ask a question?
Go right ahead.
Okay, so are you saying that you wouldn't recommend taking forward a Keeping Children Safe Act, a motion, if you don't have evidence of harm?
Oh, definitely not.
Okay.
Yeah, Tyler.
We would have a really hard time with that one on appeal.
Just Tyler is a basic motion to suspend visitation and make certain you have the evidence that visitation is not in the child's best interest. It's not a harm standard, it's a best interest standard. But, you know, even the Florida Supreme Court in Beagle v. Beagle said that necessarily a lot of decisions on best interest and necessarily include a finding of harm. So quite often for us to sustain that best interest finding for suspending visits, there will be a factor of harm wrapped up into the evidence and the finding. Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Anybody else? All right, if there's nothing further, speak now or hold peace. All right, then we will go ahead and end the call. Thank you so much for calling in today.